Good afternoon. I'm Jimmy Buff, and welcome to the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future Book Club. We've been airing chapters of this extraordinary book, edited by Sean Chamberlain from the writings of David Fleming's Lean Logic, for a bunch of weeks now, and you can hear the previous weeks at the archive, on the archive at RadioKingston.org, on the Jimmy Buff Loves You page, and follow along at home, if you will. Via the magic of radio, even though he's not actually in the studio with me at this moment, have an opportunity to have Peter Buffett join us once again for this, right? Mr. Buffett.
Jimmy Buff.
It is the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future Book Club. Last week, we heard part one of chapter four. And in thinking about it, and in thinking about the previous chapters and the introduction and preface and editor's preface and thing, that are all on the archive page at RadioKingston.org. You have said a number of times that surviving the future is essentially why Radio Kingston is here.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, it's all about community, and it's all about the aspects of community that have to be revived, remembered, reimagined. That book has it all, and Radio Kingston is here to send that out into the world.
Well, over these weeks, and as we hear these chapters, and we're going to hear part two of chapter four in just a moment, it has become really clear to me that that is what Radio Kingston is becoming. And right. Just an incredible thrill to sort of pace it along with the reading and the airing of this book.
Yeah, and then to see the future unfold before our very eyes out in the world, and to feel like that the station and what it's able to do and represent, it can be a part of that in its community. It's incredible. Yeah.
Peter Buffett, Jimmy Buff, the second half of chapter four, titled Carnival, begins this way.
Play. Carnival presented a concentrated opportunity for play. Play resists definition. As one expert on the subject, Stuart Brown, protested on being asked for one. I adopted my usual academic stance. I don't really use an absolute definition, I said. Play is so varied, it's pre-verbal, pre-conscious. But think of it like this. There are forms of interaction with people which have a direct and serious instrumental purpose. I am here to teach you Greek. I would like to order a goulash. Please dig that ditch. What have you done with my socks? And then there are all other forms of interaction. The reason we are talking about Barcelona is because we happen to be having sandwich lunch together and we are not strangers. If we were baboons, we might do a spot of mutual grooming. In Surviving the Future, play consists of all our interactions other than instrumental ones. And even the instrumental ones are rarely quite free of it. At the checkout, you still, quite often, get a hello. Play, accordingly, comes in many varieties. There is no need to list them, but the benefits they bring are many and varied. For children, play is essential to the process of developing critical, manual, emotional, and social skills, as well as imagination, autonomy, empathy, and a joined-up mind and body. The market economy's success in making people in this sense is mixed. Play with young children adds nothing to gross domestic product, unless you get someone else to do it for you, but then the bonding can get complicated. But worry not, for the task of trying to repair the wreckage when the unplayed with arrive at school shows up as an important contributor to GDP, and as an equal opportunity job provider. A pity, then, that the lean economy won't be able to afford it. It might be forced to prevent the problem arising in the first place. But play is not just for children. It is inclusive. In fact, play, making music, sport and other games, mealtime conversation, listening to stories, is one of the few activities that families or other groups with a wide range of ages can interact in as a group and as equals. And adults have their playtime too. The busy diary of carnival in medieval society bonded them in ways that lasted long after regular order was restored. The 12 days of celebratory misrule over Christmas, the boy bishops, Plough Monday, Candlemas, Valentine, Shrove, Passion, Palm, Easter, Hocktide, May Day, Whitsun, Rogation, St. John, St. Peter, Harvest, the Season of Fairs, Hobby Horses, Martinmas, All Saints. You do not cooperate in this amount of festival without getting on with each other rather well. That is capitalism for you. In another form, a wealth of social capital, potential for cooperation in more serious matters. As Johann Huizinga writes, play community generally tends to become permanent even after the game is over, and permanent community means order. Play creates order, is order. Play demands order, absolute and supreme. The least deviation from it spoils the game, robs it of its character and makes it worthless. The profound affinity between play and order is perhaps the reason why play seems to lie to such a large extent in the field of aesthetics. Play has a tendency to be beautiful. It may be that this aesthetic factor is identical with the impulse to create orderly form, which animates play in all its aspects. And, of course, community membership is not only about cooperating. It is also about coping with non-cooperation and surviving offence. Insult plus play equals friendship, sometimes even love. Play opens up the possibility of that crucial combination of accomplishments in relationship, competition and cooperation. Play is the content of carnival. And what is it for? It lifts the spirits, it prevents boredom, it contains and neutralizes aggression, it releases endorphins, it bridges the distance to another person, it allows exuberant self-expression and trusting encounter. Love explores another country. Play does so by invitation only. It may be formal, bound by explicit rules and within agreed boundaries of time and place, or informal, where these restraints are implicit and flexible, or the rules may be invented for a moment of fantasy, benign insult or humour. The rules of play make it uninhibited. You can do and say things, aggressive or insulting things, for instance, which would be out of the question except in the shadow world of play. Aspects of personality which would never otherwise have been suspected are discovered or displayed. Play manifests the person. It is intrinsic to the expressiveness of the public sphere. Play is its own thing. As the naturalist Richard Mabie suggests, we may get closer to understanding play by not trying so hard. Mabie tells us of field biologist Professor Bernd Heinrich's 5 years of meticulous analysis of the behaviour of ravens while at lunch on a coyote-killed sheep. They yell out to others to join them, roll on their backs in the snow, flutter in it, kick it and slide in it. After evaluating and rejecting all the hypotheses available to him from the sciences of behaviourism and natural selection, he settled for the obvious. They were doing what all young creatures do at feast times. They were having fun. Perhaps even birdsong, along with all its territorial tasks, is at heart a purely emotional outburst, an outpouring of sheer aliveness and without referential meaning, in which case it is genuinely closer to music than language. And maybe, observes an egret, heron, playing with a large flock of a quite different species, lapwings, matching their wing beats and swoons, their every move, in a wildly gratuitous celebration of life. Was it seeking reassurance or company, or just an outing in the sun? At times, it seems as if the whole company of nature, ourselves included, is simply at play. The long descent. And yet, with the transition from a rural-centred culture to a city-centred one, human carnival began its decline. The market economy suffers from play deprivation. It does exist to a weakened extent in professional sport, But even there, the aim of winning is increasingly taken as the literal purpose of the event, rather than the enabling myth. When such critical cultural assets as trust, social capital, and the humour which blunts insult are in decline, play is in trouble. Insult and rough and tumble are now largely forbidden. If an invitation to play is rejected or misconstrued, if a joke goes wrong, there is shame, or worse. Carnival is subdued. In fact, that transition has been in various states of advance or retreat for thousands of years, and reports of its death, and that of Carnival's impresario Dionysus, have come and gone accordingly. One of them, told by Plutarch from the reign of Tiberius, 37 to 14 BC, came in the haunting lament from the island of Pelodes, where the preferred name for Dionysus was Pan. The story tells of a Greek merchant ship whose crew, passing the island of Paxos, heard a loud cry instructing Thamus, a sailor on the ship, to pass on a message. The great god Pan is dead. When they came to Pelodes, Thamus duly shouted the message. In reply came a wailing and lamentation from many voices, unseen in the forest. And, more subtly, a story from much earlier. Homer, circa 700 BC, tells us how the art of the ancient dream world lay in wait to seduce Odysseus and his crew as they were about to encounter the sirens, whose bewitching song lures everyone who hears it to their death, their bodies added to the pile of mouldering skeletons in the meadow where the sirens sat. On the advice of his mistress, Circe, the goddess who lives on the island of Aea, Odysseus stopped up the ears of his crew with wax, so that, unable to hear the song, they were not distracted from the real work of rowing. He himself, being securely strapped to the mast, could now listen to the sirens' voices with enjoyment, as Circe puts it, and without being drawn irresistibly into their power. This has various interpretations, but one of them makes it a decisive detachment from art. The sound of ancient myth, which once drew its hearers in without means of escape, is rendered sensible and civilized, reduced to a concert, a sort of Hellenic music evening with female chorus, and a professor of Greek to tell us something about the local legend that lies behind it. On this view, we see the breaking of the link between art, music in this case, and politics. Now you only need to buy your ticket, be a spectator of the arts for an hour or so, and then home for herb tea and bed. As Alistair MacIntyre notes, the contrast, indeed the opposition, between art and life provides a way of exempting art, including narrative, from its moral tasks. And the relegation of art by modernity to the status of an essentially minority activity and interest further helps to protect us from any narrative understanding of ourselves. In the 17th century, the decline of carnival in the West began in earnest. There were many reasons. The early stirrings of capitalism encouraged habits of soberness, and it has this fixation about people turning up for work on Monday morning. Some carnivals were getting out of control, becoming the starting point for rebellion and riot. Robin Hood's career began as a carnival king. Ben Kett's rebellion in 1549 started in Wymondham, at a festival for St. Thomas a Becket. And the invention of firearms had its effect. It meant, of course, that a reckless crowd could also be dangerous, but, more important than that, it introduced a need for discipline, especially in armies. The loading and firing of a musket is complicated. It requires a sequence of steps, 43 of them according to Prince Maurice of Orange's drill, each of which must be done exactly, at speed, and, on occasion, under fire. Discipline becomes critical. Sober citizenship, which is good for armies and good for trade, calls for self-awareness and self-control, and it gets lost in the spontaneous exuberance of carnival. At the same time, the loss of carnival is serious. It invites the bleak question, what is the point? The consequences are various, no doubt, but among them may be loneliness, boredom, anxiety, and depression. If society is less fun, its inequalities are more resented. There is no constant reminder of the teeming vitality beneath the surface of other people. There is a loss of authority by the local community, which becomes less audible, less visible, less alive, less fertile as a source of laughter. Barbara Ehrenreich wonders whether the waning of carnival might have had something to do with the awareness of depression, which, in the early 17th century, seems to have developed almost on the scale of a pandemic. Before then, there was, of course, pain and grief, all the dark emotions. But loneliness and anxiety? Tactile deprivation, the sadness of not being touched? The sense of the party being over? Here, for instance, we have a solitary lament from the touch-deprived John Clare, long after the passing of Carnival. I am, yet what I am none cares or knows. My friends forsake me like a memory lost. I am the self-consumer of my woes. They rise and vanish in oblivious host, like shades in love and death's oblivion lost. And yet I am, and live with shadows tossed. Into the nothingness of scorn and noise, into the living sea of waking dreams, where there is neither sense of life nor joys, but the vast shipwreck of my life's esteems. And e'en the dearest that I loved the best are strange, nay, rather stranger than the rest. John Clare, I Am, 1844. On the other hand, we have Robert Burton's prescription, his cure for the black humour of melancholy. Your depression would have to be truly awful not to lift when that cheerful Dr. Carnival shows up. Let them use hunting, sport, plays, jousts, merry company, which will not let the mind be molested. A cup of good drink now and then, hear music, and have such companions with whom they are especially delighted. Merry tales or toys, drinking, singing, dancing, and whatever else may procure mirth. Robert Burton, The Anatomy of Melancholy, 1621. Carnival and community. At the start of this chapter, there was a claim that carnival brings the three central properties of community building, the radical break, second nature, and sacrifice and succession, to the making and sustaining of community. So, how have we done? The radical break is there. The key insights come from Rabelais, whose subject was laughter, the language of fearlessness. In a strange way, laughter confers protection, and this may help to explain why Rabelais had a long and comparatively trouble-free life. At a time when much milder criticisms of the established order would lead to their serious-minded authors being burned at the stake. Carnival is about laughter, and laughter inspires insight and solidarity. It would be going too far to say that a radical break is impossible without laughter, but it certainly helps. Like the screen behind which legendary mime Marcel Marceau momentarily disappeared when switching from being a fierce giant to a terrified pygmy, and back again. Laughter gives you a brief phase of invisibility in which you can change your mind, and perhaps your life, without having to explain yourself. Change? What change? In the presence of laughter, you don't have to answer impertinent questions like that. And second nature, with its folly, its jokes and lack of dignity, its laughter at the intellectual, its wildness and its equality, second nature would be a distinct nuisance if it were allowed to get involved in matters of political graft and calculation. But it is a lifeline. If you act as a pillar of the community, you will be an invaluable part of the collective purpose of giving it stability and making it real. But if you think in your heart of hearts as a pillar of the community, you will be a bore. You will be limited to the utterance, reductionist, joyless, banal. The mockery and critical faculty of your subconscious and its dreams will be banished until your retirement, or maybe your death. Second nature calls your bluff. Are you really an upstanding member of the community, or just on your best behavior? It is the enabling folly which makes it okay to engage your subconscious mind, to listen to dreams, to recognize absurdity, even if you are its source, to tolerate brilliance, even if you are not its source, and to develop judgment. It takes us beyond being good citizens who know, privately, that we only have to pretend to be good, since no one will notice the fake. And second nature, if not cared for, can go feral. In 1425, Fra Bernardino persuaded the people of Perugia to ban their Battle of Stones. An understandable reform, since the fatalities were beginning to get excessive. However, at the same time, he also insisted on an end to gambling, elaborate clothes and cosmetics. At first, citizens agreed to go along with all this, starting with a huge bonfire of the vanities in the piazza. But the pious mood passed, and in due course they were back to their old ways, without the battle, but with a new and exaggerated tendency to homicide and mugging. Likewise, the saintly Savonarola's death in 1498 released the people of Florence from similar inhibitions, and they reverted with enthusiasm to the gambling hells, the taverns, the brothels, and scenes of profanity such as Florence had never before witnessed. The market economy is a fragile defence against such things, but they are going on under the smooth surface of the well-behaved, and there is a limit to how long it is possible to keep a straight face. Men need wild. Aye, and women too, as Clarissa Pinkola Estes writes. No matter by which culture a woman is influenced, she understands the words wild and woman intuitively. The memory is of our absolute, undeniable, and irrevocable kinship with the wild feminine, a relationship which may have become ghosty from neglect, buried by over-domestication, outlawed by the surrounding culture, or no longer understood anymore. We may have forgotten her names. We may not answer when she calls ours, but in our bones we know her. We yearn towards her. We know she belongs to us, and we to her. Lean community will depend not just on our best behavior, but on our whole nature. And sacrifice and succession. One of the symbols of carnival is the act of giving birth. In his Italian Journey, the journal of his visit to the Roman Carnival of 1788, the poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe describes a curious scene in the opening stages of the carnival. It is not really all that comic, nor original, nor exciting. It occupies instead a position in between these, a sort of mimed logo for the meaning of carnival. A group of, usually men, appears. They are dressed up in various ways, some as peasants, some as women, and one of the women shows signs of heavy pregnancy. A quarrel breaks out, fake swords are drawn, there is dueling and fake death. The pregnant woman is terrified, falls down in the street and goes into labour. The others gather round her and in due course produce, well, a cat perhaps, or a bag of potatoes, or a formless object. It is the sheer wetness of this joke which gives it significance. It seems to come from far away, borne on the wind from a Greek island, a mime of the single phenomenon of death birth, an assertion of collective immortality. And, in Goethe's journal, the same theme comes in a collective sketch as the carnival closes. It is nighttime now, and in the final procession down the Corso in the Festival of Fire, everyone has a candle, un moccolo, to carry. Then comes the chant, sia ammazzato chi non porta moccolo, death to anyone who is not carrying a candle. Whereupon they try to blow out each other's candles, sort of condemning each other to death. Sia ammazzato il signor padre, death to you, sir father. It doesn't seem a friendly way to end a family day out, But that process of sacrifice and succession, stirrup and werde, die and become, death of the parts in the interest of the whole, birth and death belonging on the same cobblestones, is as intrinsic to resilience and to continuity as oxygen is to water. And in his poem, Selige Sehnsucht, Goethe reflects on this. Und solang du das nicht hast, dieses Stirb und Werde, bist du nur ein trüber Gast auf der dunklen Erde. And as long as you do not possess this die and become, you are but a gloomy guest on the dark earth. Order and misrule, death and life, the sage and the ass, strange attractors, dependencies and paradoxes have their day in carnival. The community building of the future will explore the intensely unfamiliar. The assumptions of the present will be laughable. Emerging communities, in contrast, will grow their own common sense, releasing the creative potential of collective folly, while breeding new strains of good judgment for a different world. Carnival is a time to move on from being lean, from being so logical, from thinking so hard, and to grow into simply practicing our culture. It is the act which gives the community its life, its conception. Start with a party.
Starts with a party.
What else do you have to say, really? I think that's it.
And I've heard you say that a lot since you first picked up Surviving the Future, Peter Buffett.
Yes, exactly. If there's one phrase that gets everybody feeling good, it's start with a party.
It's an amazing chapter. I'm listening to the second half of chapter four. For time purposes, you put the two together, and I just can't help but think that we've got the formula backwards. You know, right. When I think about the epidemic of anxiety and depression and loneliness that, according to this book, began in the late 1700s when people right. started to get sort of funneled into this idea that your worth was your work.
Right, exactly. And the definition around that, he said, I wrote a couple things down, as I always do, because the market economy suffers from play deprivation, right? And it is. You start to, you know, I read recently that it was in 1345 that minutes were 60 seconds and hours were 60 minutes. And, you know, you think of how our consciousness is just completely consumed by time in every way, and the carving up of that, and then everything gets delineated into these grids, where's play in all of that?
And so the antidote is a pharmaceutical one in a
right.
lot of instances,
exactly,
without
yep.
diminishing the desperate need for some people to actually, you know, rely on medication, but there are other instances, and I've seen this in friends and family, where play would be the answer.
No question. You know, kids often hold the answers if we just watch them, and that's that. And what I was struck by is that, you know, he starts this section by saying that play resists definition, right? Because it's free and it's joyful and it's boundless. But he also says that play creates order. And that's what I think people forget is that, you know, so often this idea of, oh, it'll just be chaotic. You know, if we let people just do what they want, or if we let the kids go, it'll, you know. But the truth is, no, people want to create something where they can play within it, have fun within some kind of a structure. I mean, it's why games have rules and music, you know, has notes and harmony and things that you follow. But then within that is where all the imagination and the joy lies.
And, you know, there's a bit in this chapter as well that we just heard about. It's subtitled The Long Descent, the paragraph, and in it, the idea that insult and rough and tumble are now largely forbidden. If an invitation to play is rejected or misconstrued, if a joke goes wrong, there's shame or worse. and Carnival yeah. is subdued. And we're in a place of identity politics and call-out culture, and some of which I understand. I understand why that is. But some of it seems a little bit like it's going to circle back on itself and end up being more detrimental to the overall.
Right. There's no room for error or no room for, oh, maybe I misunderstood you or, any of that. It is so clear. And that, you know, when you talk about that, too, the other, which you alluded to before, too, the sense of the party being over when he talks about that and the idea that you can't just have fun, and it does lead to depression and loneliness, and that's where the opioid addictions and everything else start to come in to say, what I know I'm missing something, but I can't find where to find it. You know, I can't find this place where I can suddenly be joyful and be with people and again make mistakes, say the wrong thing and go oops, as opposed to never be able to recover.
Yeah, within the past couple of years, there's been a bit that's gone viral around the recovery world, of which I've been a part of for a long, long time. And it has to do with someone, I forget the author's name, but suggesting that a real root cause of addiction is loneliness, is lack of connection, is more a contributing factor to addiction than almost anything else.
Yeah, I would say that's got to be true. I mean, and of course, the social media and the internet in general is just capitalizing on that and creating these false constructs of connection. And honestly, I mean, if we're not in a space with other people, it's why live events still are the, you know, thing to do and go to. And, you know, being in the room with someone and interacting in real space and time is a joyful experience, or it's certainly a feeling experience, which is what we're lacking in so many ways.
It's Jimmy Buff. It's Peter Buffett. It is the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club, just finishing up chapter 4. The previous chapters, including part 1 of chapter 4, already archived at RadioKingston.org. You can follow along there. You can pick up a copy of the book at Rough Draft in Uptown Kingston. You can click on the link on our social media page to go to the Chelsea Green Publishing website to get a copy of the audiobook. I listen and read along at the same time.
Right.
I find that really helpful. And we highly recommend it. We thank Chelsea Green and also Sean Chamberlain, who edited Surviving the Future down from the writings of David Fleming's Lean Logic. Peter Buffett, what do you say we go out and play?
Let's do it.
And then we did it. That's portion of listening to the Surviving the Future recorded on Saturday evening. Peter Buffett out of town today. And so after we finished up that recording, we went out and played. We went to the Hudson Valley Votes concert at UPAC in Kingston, and it was fun. It was great. It was play.